Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Please consider supporting Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United, YEG, for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Adam from Toronto, and I support Creative Control because Vish is full stop one of the best arts interviewers in Canada, or anywhere in the world, really. He approaches every episode like he's known the artist for years, creating a conversational atmosphere that gets straight to the heart of the work. No one else in podcasting gets it quite right like he does, with a mixture of meticulous research, wise artistic insights, and well-humored personal connections. I proudly support Vish and Creative Control on Patreon. You should too.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Charlie Steen is a gifted singer, lyricist, and performer who hails from South London in the United Kingdom. Since 2014, Steen has been the primary vocalist in the explosive band Shame, which has released two acclaimed albums via Dead Oceans to date, with a third one on the way on February 24th, 2023. It's called Food for Worms and will prompt the band to go on a long, long worldwide tour, beginning with Canadian dates in Alberta, including a stop at the Winterruption Festival in Edmonton on January 27th. Because of these developments, in an unusual and I believe unprecedented circumstance for Creative Control, I am finally presenting an interview I conducted with Charlie that actually took place some 20 months ago. Why such a delay? Well, in 2021, the pandemic was still something that made plans abnormal, and in my case, I was pitching or granting so many topical interview requests, at various points, I'd have like 3 months worth of weekly interviews recorded in advance, and I was having trouble getting them out to you in a timely manner that also might help support people's album release and tour dates, which were still kind of dodgy back then. Everything was constantly being postponed or canceled. I guess that's still kind of happening, actually, because the pandemic continues, but I digress. Anyway, one of the casualties of this bizarre, too many interviews, not enough time situation for me was this great talk with Charlie, in which we discussed the second Shame album, Drunk Tank Pink, whether the English really care that much about the monarchy and 2021 pandemic life in London, his strange living arrangements at the time and loneliness, binging shows like The Sopranos, The Wire, and in my case, Seinfeld, and the comfort that large ensemble shows can provide in times of isolation, future plans, which are now current plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it, and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, which is the primary source of revenue for all of the work that I put into this podcast. If you'd like to support the show, I appreciate it, and you can learn more about how to do that, again, at patreon.com/creativecontrol. With additional support from Blackbird Music, a wonderful record store with locations in Edmonton and Calgary, Alberta, and very friendly people who work there who will happily help you with whatever it is you need. Say you want to order the older Shame albums or the new one. What if you want to order that one? You know, Food for Worms. You just go over there to blackbird.ca, and that website and the people there will help you. So thanks again to Blackbird. Again, learn more about them at blackbird.ca. And support your local independent record stores. Plus, in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 743 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely, talented, and very patient, I hope, Charlie Steen of Shame, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Sorry again for the delay here, Charlie. Hi, Charlie. How you doing?
I'm very good, Vish. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's lovely to have you on. I can tell by your accent you don't live too close to me. Where in the world are you today?
I'm sat in my living room in South London, in Peckham Rye, to be exact.
Okay. See, these are things I don't know. I've only been to London really once in my life, when I was 12, en route to India. I shouldn't even say I've been to London. I've been to Heathrow. I guess. So I don't know it super well. How are things going in London at the moment, would you say? Have you been outside? What's going on in the city? I guess I should say, if you will, condolences. We've just heard the news as you and I are speaking. Prince Philip passed away only hours ago. So how are you? I know people have strange feelings about the monarchy. How are you feeling about that?
It didn't really, do you know what I mean? It hasn't changed my life around, you know. I saw an Instagram post about it. I don't know. I mean, 99 years is a fucking long time to live. You're fine to swear on this show, right?
Oh, yeah, you can swear all you like. Yeah. It's no
wicked.
Yeah.
I don't think the city's in mourning, not where I am, maybe in other parts of the city, but, you know, I went for a walk today. It didn't seem like anyone, you know, there wasn't anyone wearing black or whatever.
Yeah.
Normal day.
As you travel the world, as you used to anyway, as a musician and whatnot, did you get a sense of what others thought of the monarchy, what they thought of England per se? Like, did you ask people, like, what do you, because we end up, you know, when those two, what are their names? I don't even know that. Meghan and what's the other guy's name? Harry.
Harry.
I don't know much. I don't know much about it. I just, it comes up in the news, and I'm like, okay, I guess I gotta pay attention to this. But are you aware that people are really fascinated by these people outside of England?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really beat America with that. I mean, sort of people, you know, some people think that we sort of, you know, have dinner with the Queen every night and, you know, walk around in top hats and stuff like that and still sweeping chimneys. But, you know, it's funny. I mean, I think it's something you're very much aware of. And I mean, I think one thing about British music, or, you know, music from this sort of part of the world in general, is quite politicized. And so growing up, I mean, you know, with bands like Sex Pistols and stuff like that, you're very overtly aware of it, and people are sort of very open about the monarchy. And, you know, as you can see, it's sort of, you know, all over the world, it's front page news. So you're aware of the context of it, but it doesn't really make it, you know, it doesn't really have an impact on your daily routine. But yeah, it's funny talking to Americans. In Australia, we met some people who knew about it, but not really in other places. Maybe when we've been to Tokyo and stuff, but yeah.
Yeah. I think probably for some of us who were colonized by the English, there's a little fascination with our masters. You know what I mean? Like, I think as Canadians, we still have the Queen on our money, for crying out loud. And so that's why I can understand, as Canadians, you know, we still defer to the royal family. But you're saying in town, this kind of stuff doesn't impact you on a regular basis.
Well, I think it's something that you're so aware of, that from such an early age, like I was saying, that it's not, you know, I guess you don't think about it every day, but it is, yeah, like you're saying, when we've been to Canada and you've seen the Queen's face on banknotes and stuff like that,
yeah,
it does become a bit strange. it's a weird thing in general. Like I was saying about, you know, the overt politicism within music and art and, you know, everything else. You know, growing up, especially sort of like the bands and the artists that I've been interested in, you've always been aware of the criticisms and critiques, you know.
Yeah.
You're not taught about them in school, really, or anything like that.
But they inform your work. They inform your work as an artist. Like, for those who haven't heard Shame yet, I mean, when I listen to Shame, I do hear aspects of that tradition you're describing, if you will. I mean, it's punk is usually not about tradition, nor is post-punk, but I hear, like, you know, Gang of Four or Sex Pistols maybe, or what have you. Like, I hear a little bit of that in your work. Did those bands, their politics, like, did you feel compelled to get into art making from that point of view of, like, I'm going to say something that speaks to, like, broader social concerns? Is that something that you feel goes on in the work of Shame?
Well, I think within sort of, like, you know, the, whether it's growing up in London or whether it's just the British culture in general, is sort of to be quite outspoken, to be, you know, you even have it within sort of, you know, sort of newspapers like Punch and Private Eye that have come before, to question things, I guess. I think, you know, there's a lot more sort of the necessity to be outspoken. I don't know, I guess it just comes, we just want to complain about everything, and I think there are definitely times when it's you know, you know, we run it, after we've spoken about the weather, you need something else to complain about.
So, yes,
you know, the next natural step is the monarchy.
Is it complaining, or is it just thinking? It's just thinking, contemplating things, isn't it?
Yeah, it's. I think it's a bit of all of them. I don't know. I think with our sense of humor as well, you know, it's quite. It's very satirical, I guess. You know, and a lot of that comes from sort of looking at the absurdity of a lot of the situations that revolve around politics or within the monarchy or within the, you know, the arts, the music, and, you know, stuff like that. And I think all of it, you know, we're a small island, you know, it's all quite reflective and sort of pointed towards something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's fair. My understanding of your trajectory in Shame is that your band used to, pre-pandemic, let's call it, tour a lot. Were you guys road dogs? Would you hit the road for long spells?
We definitely did, yeah. I mean, we started when we were pretty young. I was 16, the rest of the guys were 17. But when we got to the stage of touring, when we were 18 or 19, pretty much from then, it was sort of three straight years. I mean, the year before we released our first record, Songs of Praise, I think we did like 168 shows. And the year we released it, we did 172.
Holy Lord, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. We once did, what was it, one summer we once did 47 festivals.
Really? In one summer? Okay, so that is... I don't know of anyone. I don't know of anyone who does that. That's incredible. Wow.
I mean, it's pretty nuts.
Whereabouts would you have played? I mean, with that many shows, I would think you would have covered a good part of the globe. But are there places that you haven't played? I guess maybe that's an easier way. With all those shows, is there anywhere you didn't go to on the planet?
Well, the thing is that most of those shows are within Europe. I mean, there's a lot of. You know, there's still a lot of ground to cover. You'd be surprised how many terrible festivals they can put up in, you know, in Germany, and ask you to drive around it several times. But, you know, it's the only one in the world we haven't been. We haven't been to New Zealand. We haven't been to several parts of Asia.
Hmm.
Haven't been to India. You know, there are lots of places that still like to play. Haven't been to the Caribbean. Conveniently for most I guess, like guitar bands, it doesn't seem like, you know, none of the places you seem to play are ever actually that nice. You know, it's not like you go to Barbados and play a show and you get to spend time on the beach. You know, usually you'll just be sort of in Lithuania, which I still really enjoy. But, you know,
just one cityscape after another, mostly.
I guess it's a lot more urban, yeah.
Yeah, urban, right, yeah. And I mean, I can see you hesitating to criticize it because I assume you long to play such shows at this point. I assume you've been kind of grounded since the pandemic started, yes?
Yeah, I've actually had quite a weird one. I spent, in the first pandemic, I lived in a trailer, in a caravan for 3 months. In the West Country, in Somerset, in England, mm-hmm. with my girlfriend at the time, and then with her friend's parents, like they were like on their field, I guess. And so I was doing like work with them, helping them out with gardening and construction, and then came back to London, got evicted from a nursing home that I was living in where I wrote a lot of the lyrics to our second record.
A nursing home? You lived in a nursing home?
Yeah, so one of my best mates, one of my oldest mates, Sean, the guitarist in the band, Shane, his cousin, very close-knit family, South London. There's a lot of them, the Smiths, and and not the band. So his cousin, who I'd known since I was seven, he's a few years older than us, was living in a nursing home, and it's part of a scheme called Guardianships, which is like, say like you wanted to buy a building, yeah, mm-hmm. And you wanted to turn it into a block of flats. So say you wanted to buy a nursing home, for example, and you're going to turn it into a block of flats. In between the time where you get the money to turn it into that, or you get the licensing or whatever you fuck you need, you can get these people to live in there and you don't have to pay bills, but you're just like people who make sure people don't break in and you pay rent. And I lived there illegally, and we made the washing machine room my bedroom, which is where I wrote, and I painted it all pink, which is where we wrote the record and why it's called Drunk Tank Pink, which is another story in itself. But so I'm going on a bit of a long tangent.
No, it's fine.
It's not called, I got back from Somerset. I got evicted, scrounging around to try and find a place to live for a month, which is pretty hard in COVID.
Yeah.
While we were preparing to launch the album campaign, then found a place, we were going to go to Norway to write 5 days, stay with the person who owned the Queen's Head, which used to be in Brixton, which is where we started the band. Went to the middle of nowhere in Norway, started to write. The rest of the guys flew back to London. I thought I'd stay for 2 days. They all turned out to have COVID.
Your band, your whole band?
All the band, the person we were staying with, Tickner, the sound engineer and the sound engineer's friend who popped in for the day, I didn't have it. I was the only one. So I was then put in isolation in Norway, and I was there for a month, which was amazing. And I came back on that Christmas day. Then we released the record in January.
Holy, okay. That is really tumultuous. First of all, how did everyone fare with COVID? Is everyone okay?
They all got it. They all, so it was, Josh was the one who we think was patient zero. But the problem is that he was saying he was a bit ill, but he's someone who, he's not a hypochondriac, but, you know, he's always ill.
Right. Always. Has a cold or something.
Always. So yeah. It's not something, you know, he had like a headache when we were there, and it was just, we were drinking a lot. So it wasn't something you'd think about.
Sure.
And also where we were in Norway, I mean, there's 6 million people in that whole country. There's about 6 million people within a mile radius of where I am in London right now. So, you know,
yeah, right.
You know, it's you just feel like we were in the middle of the woods, in the middle of nowhere. So you just feel, we weren't going to the shops. We were already isolating upon arrival. So we just didn't think of possibility. But Josh got it pretty bad. Charlie, our drummer, got it pretty bad. Eddie got it pretty bad. Everyone, and Tickner, who I was staying with, he just said it was kind of like a light hangover for 3 days.
Oh, okay. So they got it in a light manner and their bodies fought it off and they're okay.
Yeah, I think they're all right now. Charlie ended up, he got diabetes recently, our drummer, at the age of 24, which is pretty shit.
Oh, no.
Which they think might have been accelerated by COVID. They're not really sure, but...
Jesus, yeah.
Yeah, but he's a trooper. He's dealing with it well.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you all... I mean, and you, how do you feel not getting it? Did you feel guilty? I'm the only one who didn't get it?
No, I felt wicked.
felt fortunate. Let's say, just for the sake of everyone else, you felt fortunate.
I felt fortunate, yeah. Okay. I felt fortunate. Oh, we've all had our vaccine now as well.
Oh,
we got our first. We all got our first jab. Shout out to the Croydon Islamic Center and Mosque.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we got our first jab. So, and a lot of people I know in London have gotten their first or if not their second. So it's all, things are looking a bit, going back to a question earlier about how sort of London at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's just knackered of it, you know, and they're sort of just like, you know, but everyone's sort of talking about getting the vaccine as if you're getting COVID. People got hit heavy. I got AstraZeneca along with everyone else.
Oh, right. And, which is the questionable, as we're speaking, yeah. It's the questionable vaccine.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think it's ridiculous about all of that. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, one in I don't know the statistics, I'm trying shit, but you know, one in however many people get blood clot. It's like, you know, you're more likely to get blood clot.
Well, it's hard to explain to someone that people 55 and under are more susceptible to the side effects, supposedly, of that vaccine. So usually, you know, you're not supposed to do something once you are 50, 60 years old. So I've never heard of this. It seems to be... Anyway, let's not jinx you. I'm not going to assume you're going to be fine. Let's not get, it can hear us. So I don't want to get too far into, let's not get cocky or anything. It's just,
That's true.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
So
it is what it is.
I was reading about the preparation that you undertook to make Drunk Tank Pink, which is a fantastic record. It's so great. And rip roaring. I kind of needed it. I've been listening to lots of quieter synthesized music, and it's been a while since I've had a real strong, you know, guitar rock, post-punk, if you will, kind of record. Do you hate that term? People keep throwing that term at Shame. Do you hate any of the terms that people use to describe your band?
No, they're a lot better than what we've been called before.
Okay.
That's, I don't mind. But also, thank you for saying that about the record, mate.
Oh, it's so great. Like I say, I've just had been blasting it so loud in my office that my family is starting to wonder. We often share, I share my music with them because, you know, if I'm interviewing someone, I need to get immersed in the song so they can be a litmus test. You know, it's playing in the kitchen, it's playing in the basement. They can be like, oh, I like this, I don't like this, whatever. So yeah, I think they've just been walking by like, is Papa okay? What's going on in there? It's so loud. And I'm like, yeah, I'll just close the door. Sorry. But anyway, it's really great. And my understanding is that there was a sort of, oddly enough, we've all undergone this period of stillness because of the pandemic, but you also kind of endured a kind of stasis, I guess, once the touring for the last run of shows you guys did before getting into this record writing process began. Is that right? You kind of were just on your own, isolated, trying to come up with songs. Is that correct?
Kind of. I mean, the thing is, in comparison to how much we toured before, we kind of, you know, it was very fortunate. We finally felt as if we were in the position where, you know, the kind of catch 22, I guess, is that, you know, you want to do all these shows and then, but you also want, you know, to not lose your mind, you know, which is a difficult tightrope.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
to sprint across. you know, so we were kind of at this stage where we were still playing shows, but they were just less frequent. And we, you know, we did, in the year we were writing the record, we did Coachella.
Oh.
We did Fuji Rock in Japan. We did, you know, we did a few festivals and we went, you know, when we did Coachella, we got to go on two tours there, one on the West Coast, one on the South and the East Coast, which was amazing.
Nice.
So I think in that respect, I think, you know, we toured so much, we toured to such an extent of that record that, you know, there's only so many times you can play 10 songs, you know.
Yeah, right.
before, you know, people ask to see a new trick. So I guess in a way, the form of isolation came from just, adapting back. I mean, you know, I've said this time before, but kind of, you know, like we were like tourists in our adolescence, you know, we went from 18 to 20 and 21 when we were just sort of like placed back and, you know, and suddenly we weren't touring all the time. And, you know, it's things like sort of, you know, we were forever with company, you know, whether that was sharing a bed or in a dressing, you know, green room, or, you know, in the back of a van. You're never sort of really on your own. You don't really have much time to think. So I think on the lyrical side, you know, throughout that period, I sort of had the natural things that I guess is common among most people of that age to go through, whether it's breakups or, you know, falling in love and all of that other stuff. But it was combined with this sort of absurd lifestyle of touring, which in itself is a great form of escapism, you know, and a large, you know, force of delay. And so when you sort of stop that, and when you come back, and when you're put into a static position, all of these things sort of suddenly come back. And, you know, a lot of the record, like I kind of said about it, to summarize it, I guess, is, you know, I don't think it's so sort of like all so down and sad or whatever, but it's just sort of like learning to enjoy your own company.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So in a sense, I gather what you're saying, it's more nuanced. You weren't just still. It just was a little more still than you had been. And so I appreciate that sort of clarification. But you endure that revelation, I guess, of like, I got to get used to just being on my own. Then the whole world has to do that. You know, you're kind of forced into it. It wasn't like just your work schedule changed for a bit. Everyone's schedule changed. How has this year and a bit now, since we've all been, you're saying London is on the come up a little bit, feeling a bit better?
It's London. London's right. I mean, so whereabouts in Canada are you?
My family and I now live in Edmonton, Alberta. We used to live, I'm from Ontario. We moved in January of 2020, just before everything locked down. We moved right across the country. My wife's family is from here, and we had job opportunities. So I decided, yeah, let's make the move. I lived for 40 odd years in Ontario. Let's try something else. And yeah, then everything shut down. So in a weird way, good timing.
We're not missing
anything from, you know, that was a fear. Our kids would miss all their friends and we would be missing out on events and gatherings, but none of that can happen. So we're not missing anything. My kids are able to have, you know, online virtual conversations with their Ontario friends from here because everyone's kind of home and, you know, that's how it is here. So yeah, I'm really locked down here. Not really. I get groceries. I don't know the city I'm in very well. I couldn't tell you. I know a couple of the streets are all numbered. So it's not like Smith Street and Shame Street. It's just like
the streets have numbers.
It's a grid. So I live on like, you know, we all live on, it's like 92nd Avenue, 83rd Street or whatever. Like, so I'm not oriented and it's so disorienting. Anyway, it's weird. I'm just, there's nothing for me to miss because I don't know anything. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer to your question. I live in Edmonton.
I live in
Edmonton, Alberta. I like just explaining it because I'm totally unmoored. Like, I have nothing to cling to in a weird way. We bought a house. That's about it.
And No.
Yeah.
I enjoy hearing about it.
Yeah, okay.
I'm picturing it in my mind. I mean, you know, what you're saying about that, it's interesting what you got onto as well about, you know, finding that silver lining of sort of you're not missing anything there, I think.
Yeah.
What I was initially going to ask about, going back to the Britishness, talking about the weather, but, you know, like here, like that's a large difference, you know, when the sun, you know, spring's now started and when the sun eventually starts to show, it really, the impact that it has on this city is sort of phenomenal in a lot of ways. And I mean, what you were saying about sort of finding the silver linings, I think, and sort of the general vibe of London, I mean, you know, I wouldn't like to brush over the devastations that have occurred during this period of time.
Yes,
sort of,
yes.
All the hard work that the NHS workers have been putting in and everybody who's been, you know, all the key workers who've been doing so much and sort of haven't stopped throughout this period. And, you know, there's been a lot of grief and there's been a lot of grievances and there's been a lot of tragedy, but it is interesting when you know, when talking to a lot of people from all ranges, from all aspects, you know, over the period of this entire time, it, you know, that is something that everybody is sort of has either found or is searching for, that sort of, you know, that light at the end of the tunnel, yeah. You know, and it comes back to this sort of idea of, you know, survival mode. You know, you can't, you know, there's only so much you can sort of, you know, shout at the telly, you know, before before you lose your voice. You know, whenever the news is on. You know, I think it's all been a period of waves, you know. I think some more fortunate than the others, and this is probably talking more about my personal experience and experiences I know from my personal friends. But you know, throughout the period, some people have been up, some people have been down, and you know, the weather and, you know, darkness and, you know, evictions and, you know, stuff like that all does have an impact. But now that the sun's starting to shine a little bit, I hope. Sorry, what were you gonna say?
Well, no, I was gonna echo what you were saying. I think sometimes, depending on what, there's a few things going on that I think some of us don't take into consideration. You're talking about the elements, and one of the big things from moving from Ontario, which is, as you know, four distinct seasons and lots of sun in the summer, hot, you know, a pleasant spring. I moved to a place that is notoriously cold, one of the coldest places in the world, Edmonton. So we moved from like, in basically two seasons, like basically you have winter and summer, like barely any fall, barely any spring. When we first got here, do you guys have Celsius? You use Celsius, don't you?
Yeah, degrees.
Yeah, so you use Celsius. So like for the first, there was 2 weeks when we first got here in January of 2020, when it was record-breaking cold every day, minus 40. And so...
Wait, whoa! Oh my days.
Right. So my point is, and that happened again this winter, but I didn't really notice it because I didn't have to go anywhere except for groceries. So my point is, which I never really thought about the weather. When people would say, what's the weather like today in Ontario? I'd say, I don't know. I don't care. I'll figure it out when I get outside. I mean, unless it was like we were planning a picnic. And if it said thunderstorms are coming, we wouldn't do the picnic. But otherwise, I'm like, I don't know. I'll bring a jacket, or if it's too hot, I'll take it off, whatever. But here, the elements are so harsh that you wouldn't go outside. You were kind of, I think a lot of people here are used to isolating for a lot longer because of the cold. So I'll throw that out there. And then the other thing I'll talk about very briefly, I think, is this pandemic hasn't impacted me on an emotional level the way it has others, because I'm with three other people all the time. I'm with my family, my wife and my two kids. There are people struggling because they are single, or they're reveling in it too. I know, like, everyone has their own experience, but I'm starting to talk to more people who are like, yeah, I don't see anyone. I stay in my apartment by myself. I write songs, or I make things, or I watch TV, but I can't, because of this pandemic, I don't see anybody. So they have this eerie, creepy silence. Whereas, you know, my wife and I are like, Jesus, when are these kids going to stop talking? But but really, like, it's your perspective. So I think when you're talking about the state of London, you know, you're trying to look at it as dynamically as possible. It's looking better, but it's been a devastating year. And that's what you're kind of getting at, I think. Is that fair?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, it's just something where, you know, I have been very fortunate in a lot of regards to this. And I don't want to sort of, I guess it's that thing of not wanting to sort of to brush over or sort of to undermine, I guess. And that's sort of, I think that is what I'm trying to get at. I mean, it's weird, like what you're saying about being, you know, I've gone through, at the beginning of this, I was with my girlfriend, and then we broke up in winter. And so I've been single for the first time during this pandemic. But it's interesting to see, like, you know, especially at 23, you know, in the thing that happened in summer in London, like I was saying about the weather, is we got so many commons. It was kind of like we were teenagers again, you know, people were socially distancing, but everybody was just out drinking on the commons again, and so you could bump into people or see people. And,
right.
And a lot of people were saying that, you know, the first one was really difficult on a lot of people. You know, a lot of people broke up during that. or had to make tough decisions. I mean, the reason I went to Somerset was because my girlfriend was down there, mm-hmm. and I left on the first day of lockdown. I left from a station called Clapham Junction, which is like one of the busiest stations in London. You know, in average day, I can't imagine how many people go through there. There are 18 platforms. I was the only one on 18 platforms.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Okay.
So it was insane. But I had to make that. I was at 6 a.m. You know, Boris Johnson made the announcement at like 8 the night before, something like that. And it was just one of those quick decisions where I was like, you know, celibacy, or should I just gamble and
get out?
You know,
yeah.
Obviously, it doesn't just come down to that. I wanted to see them, but you know, like, you know, but it is that thing, wasn't it? I remember calling them and being like, "Well, that's it, it's over." You know, in my sort of like downtrodden state of self pity. Obviously, they were just like, "Get on a train quickly." But you know, being single, it is a different experience. I mean, yeah. I got a new flatmate, and one of them left in when we were releasing the record, so around that time of January 15th, and they were away for a month. So I was in my flat for a month on my own, which at that time was really nice. But towards the end of it, I'd never seen The Sopranos before.
Oh.
I watched all of them. Oh my God, changed my life.
Yeah,
I love it so much.
That's weird. I rewatched it at the beginning of the year too. Like starting in December, I've seen it several times, like the whole thing, but I... it was on one of the streaming services, so I'm like, yeah, I'm just gonna watch this, and then I got right into it, and they're terrible people, just awful people, but I can't stop watching what they do. And so what did you make it? This was your first time watching it, and you're saying it changed your life. That's quite a statement.
I mean, TV really has that effect on me. I mean, I'd never, the first time we went into lockdown, I watched all of The Wire, which had a similar effect on me.
That's what I did. I did that too. I rewatched The Wire in the spring, and then like last spring, and then I rewatched The Sopranos. Just comfort, like weird. I wanted familiarity, but I also wanted it to be disturbing as fuck. Like it was weird. Yeah. I wanted the harshness of that reality because it's all very harsh, and a lot of anti. Like no one is noble. No one is really good. Everyone's got an angle. And so, anyway, that's weird. And now I'm watching just to close the circle.
Yeah.
I'm rewatching Seinfeld right now. And so,
Wow. I haven't seen that in long.
Yeah. So I'm rewatching it and it's incredible. I have to watch like 4 episodes at a time. I can't handle it. I'm at season 3 as we're speaking. It's really funny and really good and really well done, but also deplorable people, awful people, like just nothing but awful people all the time. And I can't stop watching them. It's weird.
I'm doing My Name Is Earl now.
Oh, nice. How's that?
I love it. So it was my childhood show and they've got it on Disney Plus. And I just love it so much. It's so good to go back to that. But going back to the slightly different vibe. But I mean, it's just such, you know, it's such incredible writing and it's such incredible performances. But I remember I watched The Wire as well. And so I'd been in my flat on my own for a month and it was the last episode of Sopranos and I just got fucking wasted. And after it finished, I just sat on my sofa, just like so pissed, like Blair and Frank Sinatra, and like called all these people. And I was like, what am I doing? Do you know what I mean? Like, maybe I'm lonely. maybe I need that. I was like, you know what I mean? It's kind of like, so I think that's sort of like human, you know, just sort of company, I guess. You just sort of need something to go through. But, you know, the problem is sort of how monotonous things can get. There's no sort of, I think that's the main thing that's sort of been lacking from social life, or you know, what really makes life worth living, in my opinion, is spontaneity.
Yeah,
you know, it's the people you bump into in the pub who you haven't seen in ages, but you know, you love them, and it's sort of meeting someone, or it's, you know, it's, I mean, how the fuck can you go on a date now? Do you know what I mean?
Like, absolutely, you know, I do. I'm very thankful that I'm not in a new city completely by myself. I think I would struggle with that. I never really thought of the idea of watching a show with an ensemble cast as being company. I never thought of it that way. But to your point, but I would agree, like in the end, I do, when I would flip on a Sopranos episode, I think subconsciously I was thinking, I'm going to hang out with these guys for a while.
It's like the only interactive TV show I've ever seen. Like, when they eat, I want to eat. When they drink, I want to drink.
Exactly. You know, yeah. I mean, hopefully that's the extent of what you want to copy them doing, because the rest of it, not great. Not great behavior.
No, it is.
That's a fascinating aspect of it. I mean, given what we were talking about in terms of the writing you did in the washing machine room for Drunk Tank Pink, and those feelings of at least a little bit of isolation, like, do you feel like the songs that we're hearing on Drunk Tank Pink are particularly relevant to what people are going through right now? Like, are there, I'm sure you didn't intend for it. Like, you made the record before this happened, right? Like, for the most part, you wrote.
Yeah, we did. We did all of it.
So do you feel like, I don't want to use the word prescience necessarily, but do you, like, is it a little creepy to you how any of the lyrical themes sort of fit with what you're going through now?
Speaking in like an honest way, and I guess one of the, you know, an honest in the sense of, it might not make me sound like, you know, that much of a selfless person, but you know, I took comfort in the fact that it wasn't just going to be another getting, you know, classic second album getting back from tour. You know, and so that was what I took comfort from. But the reason, I mean, the reason it was called, I mean, with the themes of isolation and stuff like that, the reason it was called Drunk Tank Pink was because, so that was why, as I said, like, I painted the whole room the shade of pink when I moved in, and I had the ceiling, you know, the carpet, the walls, the lampshade, everything. I mean, it was like a box as well.
You painted literally everything pink?
Yeah, it's called lip gloss pink, the color.
Interesting.
And so after we went through and we did, and sort of in that room, you know, a lot of the record is sort of going to the subconscious as well. I was sort of, it took me, I was having the first sort of like 2 months of me living there, I was having real difficulty sleeping.
Bad dreams, as I recall. You're having weird, intense dreams.
Yeah, just vivid dreams. I guess it's to that point where, you know, the dreams to me, I don't like to overanalyze everything, which would be completely hypocritical to my next statement. But, you know, it's sort of the clearest way where you sort of have to confront your subconsciousness. And I think a lot of that, you know, at that point, we didn't have the distractions at all. So I could, there are sort of portable ones you can have, such as, you know, or ones that you can build up, like going to the pub or bringing people back to yours, you know, just having constant company around you so that you're not having to spend this time with yourself. And I then found out it was actually just when we'd finished recording the record and we were going for our first meeting at Rough Trade in West London, which is where, who we're managed by. And on the way there, my mum sent me this page. She'd been reading the Book of Colours. And there's a shade of pink called Baker Miller Pink, which was designed by, surprise, surprise, a guy called Baker Miller in the 1960s in America. Because of the drug war that was going on, they wanted a way. There was such a rise in violence. They wanted a way to suppress it, and so the government called in all these like therapists and doctors, stuff like that. And this guy came up with a theory that there is a certain shade of pink that suppresses anger and violence. And so they started painting it into all these juvenile facilities. The first one was in Seattle. And it, you know, in the first, you know, per year they had like 175 cases of violence. And after a year of having the rooms painted that color, they had 4. And then they put it into classrooms and prison cells, and in the Midwest of America, Drunk Tank, which is where it was named Drunk Tank Pink. But it was just, you know, I got really, I really obsess over the bedroom, because it was sort of, you know, stuff like making your bed and, you know, messy bed, messy head, all that kind of, all that kind of stuff. You know, you never make your bed when you leave a hotel room, but, you know, unless you're talking.
Speak for yourself. I like to. No, I don't always do it, but I try. I actually do try to do it a little bit.
Really?
I feel well. I didn't do it growing up, but since I met my wife, my now wife, I'm like, right, I should make the bed. So now I just make our bed.
Well, when you leave hotel rooms,
not as if it's like a disaster, like Steph's everywhere, then I'll just okay. Since we're talking about it. By the way, I haven't been in a hotel room in probably 2 years or something by this point. But What I do is usually I put the do not disturb thing on the door. I don't want them coming in. If I'm staying for like a few days, I'll put the do not disturb thing on the thing so they don't come in and whatever, clean anything. And then, yeah, just because I'm used to doing it at home, I make the bed. So when I go to bed, it's been made because that's what I'm used to at home. But I is that make me a sociopath? Are you saying I'm crazy? I don't think.
No, we've rarely stayed in places for more than one night. I think that makes a lot more sense if you're going to stay in there. That definitely.
Maybe on the on the morning I'm leaving, I leave it alone because I realize I also think they're just, why are you making this bed on the last day? That's true. Actually, I will say that. I think I've consciously done that. I'm not going to make it the day I'm the morning I'm leaving. They're going to hopefully strip the bed of everything anyway. There's no point in making it. Like if it's like 10 a.m. and checkouts at 11, I don't make the bed. But if I'm staying there for like, if I'm being, you know, if I'm at a festival for a week or a few days, then yes, I will treat my living quarters as nicely as I can because I have to live in them. Do you know what I mean? I'm old now. I'm older than you. I'm 20 years older than you by the sounds of it. And I'm not into the debauchery. And I like to be courteous to people. I think of, you know, it's a long time, a lot of selfish behavior in my past. And so I'm trying to repent, you know, I'm trying to make up for it by trying to be as kindly as possible to anyone. Because I have to say this to my son all the time. He'll leave like a granola bar wrapper on the table. I say, who do you think is going to have to pick that up? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, well, someone else. That little thing you're doing is altering someone's day. You know what I mean?
But you should show them my name is Earl.
Well, I should.
Baby's karma.
Yeah, I should. I should probably do that. Anyway, I didn't mean to go off on a tangent about my hotel hotel etiquette.
No.
I'm just saying, yes, you're saying that you're, I don't know, why did we talk about this? Oh, yeah, cleaning the hotel rooms. What were you on about there?
So I was just talking about, you know, for the first time in a long period, you know, sort of your bedroom, I guess, and, you know, there was a poem by John Donne that really sort of hit a chord, and it's kind of, you know, it says thy bed the center of everything, I think, and that really like struck a chord with me. You know, I think it's, to me, it's sort of, you know, for the first time in a while, I guess it was mine, and I could put up what I wanted in the wall, you know, do, you know, and I was going to be going back there, you know, it was a familiarity, and it was sort of, you know, I spend a lot of time in the bedroom and, you know, like just reading and sleeping, you know, everybody else does in the bedroom. But it can sort of be sort of, it's interesting, I guess, also because for a lot of the initial stages of writing this record, it was sort of, I guess, an enemy, you know, because it was sort of an association with having to try to go to sleep and having these dreams or whatever. And so it's something that you want to try put off to deter from having to go to.
Right.
And so coming to comfort with that. And I mean, I don't even know where I was going either, but I think, you know, it's just sort of what we're talking about with that isolation and the themes and everything.
Well,
Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, invoking the bedroom in this context is fascinating too, because the bedroom as a space was on your mind. And for a lot of people, the bedroom is also a space of privacy, of security. Like you feel safest maybe in your bedroom. That's where you've taught yourself that it's the room that you can be, you can relax, you know, and not put on airs, not think of others. It's like a place of a truth, I will say, reality. Like you're just you in your bedroom or you and your partner in your bedroom, but that's when you kind of drop all facades for the day. And if I'm right about that, does that inform the songwriting? Like you're in your bedroom. That
Definitely.
That atmosphere might reveal more about you in your songs than you maybe even realize. Does that make sense?
No, that's fucking that's angelic. that really hits a chord, I guess. No, definitely. I mean, I think with this record as well, it was the first time it was sort of internal. I mean, I've said this before, but you know, we started and I was like, you know, I was 16 when we first started because I'm a July baby and we started in June. And I was just like, I don't want to fucking write about love. Like everybody writes about fucking love and heartbreaks. You know what I mean? Like everybody writes about that. And then when you go through it, you're just like, that's what everybody's been writing about this fucking thing for like 7,000 years or something, like, you know what I mean? Like, since cavemen could draw on walls,
we talk about it. It is a particular feeling that you need to grapple with and exercise from your body. And for some of us, yeah, it's cliche, but yeah, that's why people do it.
It is definitely cliche. I mean, I guess as well, the whole thing of doing this in the first place, you know, I think one of the things through lockdown as well is it sort of really, you know, it puts your priorities into perspective, and it definitely gives you a whole new perspective, I guess, on everything else. And but you really see, like, for me, I guess, you know, I haven't stopped writing lyrics. I haven't stopped, you know, doing other things like painting and stuff like that. And you sort of see that when things are stripped from you, like the possibility of touring or the possibility of recording, the reason you still pursue them is the reason you began them in the first place, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because they are cathartic, and they are necessary to your life, definitely to my life. And so, it, you know, me sort of writing this stuff, I mean, was my sort of own process of understanding. And not all of the record is about that, but I think, you know, the first, I mean, you know, when thinking about it in sort of relations to age and stuff, I mean, when we did Songs of Praise, our first record as well, like, some of those songs were written when I was doing my A-levels, which is your last year when you're 18, 17 at school.
Oh, I see. Right.
And I did English literature. And so kind of naturally I was drawn towards characters because I was always having to analyze them,
mm-hmm.
you know, with Chaucer and Virginia Woolf and Yeats and Sylvia Plath and all those others. And sort of then now, I guess, I mean, like, it's interesting. A lot of people I've spoken to as well who are in bands in the UK and Ireland who have toured a similar amount to us is that this sort of like the common, I guess, misconception. I think it depends on your personality and what you do in a band as well, but that you're going to become a lot more extroverted through touring.
Yeah.
But I think the introversy becomes such a necessity. You know, well, like I said earlier, you're never without company when you're on the road. And so, and when you're, you know, when you deal with certain things, whether that be sort of exhaustion or, you know, falling for someone or doing something like that, it's, they're kind of things when you think about them in your life, you experience on your own, you know, you think about walking to the shop and realizing that you do like that person, or you think about walking back from the shop and thinking about that person doesn't, you know, love you anymore. But, right. You know, and so, but when you're having to think about all of this in a transit van with six other people, you know, it becomes a lot more isolated in the experience. You know, you really hold on to the value of that. And so I think, yeah, again, this is a long tangent of self-indulgent, but
no, it's fine. I think it's worth exploring it, because I mean, like I said earlier, and like you've been saying, like, there's something about writing from a space of security for yourself, whether you knew it or not. But as much as you sounded like you were haunted in the bedroom by dreams, by the pinkness, maybe of your own accord, I mean, there's something really real about you in these songs as a result of this whole exercise, I'm guessing.
I think also it was a challenge that I really wanted to do. I mean, you know, it's, well, like, when we started, most of the band didn't know my lyrics for the first record until we recorded the album,
mm-hmm.
because you're playing, you know, tiny pubs and, you know, small stages and stuff like that, and the PA system doesn't work, and, you know, they're not paying attention. And when you're in a practice space, you know, we didn't have big practice spaces, which pump loads of money into,
yeah,
sort of like cheap or whatever we could get.
Right.
And this time, the way that we were writing it was, a lot of it was written in Josh's bedroom as well, another bedroom. And I was sort of having to, you know, these for the first time kind of personal lyrics. And the, you know, my bandmates are, I've known this since I was a kid, you know, a lot of them. So everybody's aware of the entire context of your whole life. So sort of recording vocals after everything else has been recorded in, and everybody can hear exactly what you're saying, every word, was sort of a completely new challenge, a completely new fear.
Right.
And I think with the band, I'm not really a musician. You know, I have so much admiration and so much respect for anyone who can. You know, what I sort of desire and what I love is performance. And so very much like when we write anything, I would sort of think about what it's going to be like to perform it. I think this has slipped less and less through the course of the pandemic, because that's, you know, isn't in the back of your mind as much anymore. But the main sort of, I guess, sort of the concrete platform that is necessary in order to do that is honesty and truth. Right. You know, I'm not a good enough actor yet to say something that I don't really mean. You know, I'm not quite a boy band member.
There's definitely an authenticity that comes through, I think, and that's good. I don't think that's a bad
thing. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, I just think in order to perform, it's very weird. It's like performance as well as like with anything is there's something that becomes so appealing. I don't know if you could refer it to like a one night stand, because I don't want to sound sort of I wouldn't want to sound as if I was, you know, something disposable, because obviously that doesn't have to be disposable.
Right.
Be treated right. In that manner. But in the way of that you can share something quite intimate with a stranger for an hour, or with a group of strangers and people that you might never see again, but you're saying something that kind of means a lot to you, and you've then got to, convince them sort of what you're saying and of what you're doing. And yes, granted, like without the band and without maybe visceral energy and stuff like that, it wouldn't come across as so. That helps it a lot. But you need to kind of believe what you're saying, I guess, because otherwise, everybody's. You don't want a show to feel jaded. You want it to feel real, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's I have been in bands for a good chunk of my life, and there is something. It's really hard to explain to some people what it means to go from the practice space to communicating your idea before an assembly of strangers. Like, that's a really, because you're basically starting, every time you start a song, you're kind of starting a conversation with someone you don't know, and they're receiving it in their own way. And at the end of your performance, they might feel compelled to come up to you and say, that really meant something, or that was interesting, or that was great, or whatever it is. They just feel compelled to be like, I need to speak to you now that you've been hollering at me for 45 minutes. It's time for me to get a word in. But I mean, that's why we go and play. I'm sure that's why part of why you probably love playing live and touring so much. You're looking to connect and you're communicating, but you're also hoping to see if it's connecting with people. And maybe I'm reading too much into that, but is that maybe a part of where you're coming from?
Definitely. I mean, as well, it's sort of, you know, it's I think like a large part of performance as well is this sort of, which goes back to what I was saying about the lyrics and stuff like that, is that, you know, and I was talking about this with a friend the other day, that, you know, I think there's a very sort of fine line between sort of like self-belief and what can come across as sort of vanity.
Yeah.
But it's the sort of idea of, you know, most people who you'll speak to who will be, you know, I'm speaking about it just from like a sort of singer's perspective, or, you know, front person perspective, because you're sort of just alone with a microphone. But I think sort of like the level of scrutiny that you're aware that you're going to go under, particularly when you're starting out, or even still, is this sort of desire to prove yourself.
Yeah.
You know, once again. And Hannah, who runs our label, record label in London, said this amazing fucking thing when we signed to them. She said, nobody's going to care more about your band than you do.
Yes.
Which is such a good, I think at that time, you know, like 18 or 19 or whatever, I was a bit, you know, cocky. I was like, well, you know, sure, we'll have a fan. But you know, I didn't really get it. But now, you know, that's sort of such a great, I think that's such a great attitude, you know, because so much of, I thought the way that we started out, which is one of like the largest tragedies throughout all of this period, is that, you know, we're so fortunate to have started when we did. And for any new bands who are starting out now, not being able to play at those independent venues, or with the threat of a lot of those independent venues closing, is that the amount of times you play to an indifferent crowd, and, you know, the last thing you want in the world is indifferent, or people who just don't like it, or, you know, like we've done shows where it's just like Eddie's dad and a couple getting off in the corner, and that was it.
But you need that. It toughens you up. It actually makes it just, it gives you resolve to keep going no matter what.
Definitely. I mean, well, yeah. The whole sort of point of this, but sorry to interrupt.
No, I interrupted with my observation, but go ahead. Yeah.
I think what it's just about, you know, I think that's sort of a lot about, in my perspective, what this band is and what it's a vehicle and be able to do is to sort of, you know, tackle your own insecurities. I mean, you know, I've said this before as well, but, you know, like the reason I take my shirt off when we play is because I was always really insecure about my weight.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like this first sort of platform where, you know, just for half an hour or for 45 minutes or 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you're not focused on what anyone is thinking about you. You have a sort of rush of a self-belief, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's so addictive about it. You know, it's sort of, you know, I sort of used to refer to it as sort of like, you know, I think that's because of how many shows we've been able to see. I think after a while, and I'm sure you've been in the same position, Vish, like, you know, it becomes a point where you become sort of like, not immune to them. That sounds weird, but I guess sometimes maybe indifferent in yourself. And that's when that gig that you do see that really does blow your mind makes it so much more impactful.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's something you can't ever put your finger on.
It isn't. I agree. And it's also, there's some truth in you had to be there to understand the feeling in the room. And whether it's a good feeling or a bad feeling, it's hard to describe to someone what a show is like. So I've had those experiences as well, both on stage and off stage, just like of seeing my favorite band have an off night, you know, or something. Like it's all very informative and human and humanizing. And I think you're right. I mean, I've talked about this on the show with others before. I miss opening bands. You know, I've been relatively okay not seeing shows. Like I used to go to so many shows a week, like just so many shows. When I lived in Ontario, they would happen where I lived in Guelph, but I would also drive an hour to Toronto on a weeknight some nights, even though I had work. I loved shows. But and I'm okay without them on the one hand, but my discovery often happened with opening bands. You know, people I have on this show sometimes, I first encountered when they were opening for someone bigger, and now they are at a level that's... Yeah, the whole anyway, I don't want to get too depressing here. It is a hard time to be on some level. You can get your music out there on the internet, of course, yourself, but that notion of playing live and finding people that way for both listeners and for musicians, I think that's really hard. And and it is going to make me feel a little out of touch with stuff. Because the opening band thing is also like, oh, this new thing I'd never heard about is blowing my mind, whether it's a young artist or an older artist. Like, it's not that they're on the come up. I just didn't know who they were. Now I'm going to dig in and find out more about them. So I don't have that same impulse, or I'm not being presented with that stuff. So I don't have the digging I'm doing for music now is kind of someone mentions it on social media or my friend tells me about it via text. So I look it up and I listen to it and I check it out. But anyway, I'm sure you've gone through that too, being an opening band, being a headlining band. There's a lot of excitement in the discovery of music making.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
I mean, it's every element, isn't it? You know, like, if you want to move on, we can move on as well.
No.
You know,
go ahead. Go ahead.
I think like the last, well, thank you. Like the last gig I saw before lockdown, before COVID happened, was the last non-socialist gig we played. We were in The Hague in the Netherlands.
Oh.
And we were doing this festival, Grauzone Festival, which was an amazing festival. We got to play with like Damo Suzuki.
Oh, nice. From Cannes, of course. Yeah,
which is amazing. But we bumped into Brady, who is an artist called Pan for Modern.
Oh,
who
yeah.
We knew him from, do you know them?
I'm aware of them. I've never encountered Brady. I'm aware of that that act, I suppose.
So it was like, we were like, he was there playing with another band, but he was doing a solo thing, Pan for Modern. And he'd been in a band that had supported us in our first ever show in LA, who were amazing. And he was like, yeah, I got this show on at like 1 a.m. and we played at like 8 or 9 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't drinking that night. And I was just like, I'm not going to drink at all. So I was kind of like hanging around, you know, till 1, which is quite a long time. and not drink, not to wait around. But and so I was like, you know, I just want to experience, you know, experience. And I really didn't know what it was. I hadn't heard his music before. And we turn up, and it's at this sort of, you know, it kind of felt like we were in Berlin or something like that. It's just like a door, and there are loads of people smoking outside. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like this door opens, and just like all of this smoke comes out, like billows out of it. We go into this like hot, sweaty basement, like down all of these stairs, and everything is just covered in smoke. You know, you can't really see your hand in front of you. And it's just him playing on stage, and like, it was just to be there was sober, you know, in a sober experience. And not that you need to be inebriated to sort of be taken aback, but it just sort of, it made me feel so much more grateful, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just sort of, it really did sort of, it was just one of those, it's like when you read a book and you, before reading the, you know, and you don't read the blurb, or when you watch a film without watching the trailer, you know, and you're just so, it's sort of in awe of the surprise, and yeah. You know, it's just sort of like it's every detail, isn't it, when something like that happens.
Absolutely.
The door opening and the smoke coming out, the walking down the stairs, the sweat in the air, the bump, you know, walking past people, you know, it's every element.
Yeah, creates a sense memory almost. I've had that. I like not reading the blurbs to books. I like not seeing the trailer for movies. Sometimes, yeah. You know, I like just, yeah, I'm with you on that. And it does create, it's part of the thing is the first impression is the surprise element of a song or a band. Yeah. Yeah. It's all lamentable, but I hope to your earlier point about London being, you know, vaccinations are happening. They're slow to happen where I'm calling you from, but I hope they will. And I hope there'll be some sense of normalcy and perhaps shame. We'll play Edmonton.
I would love that.
Have you played much of Canada?
We've done Montreal, Toronto, Quebec City, and I believe that's it. But we really love Canada. Josh, our bassist, is half Canadian.
Oh,
his
cool.
His dad's from Toronto. Montreal in particular, we all love.
Oh, it's great. Montreal is fantastic. Yeah.
Is Ontario French speaking or?
Well, the entire country is it's technically bilingual, but Ontario is more bilingual than, because we're right beside Quebec, it's primarily English speaking.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Wicked. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're right beside Quebec. So there is a lot of, my kids are in French immersion school. So they're learning French here even.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it is the official language, if you will. So yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I was just saying that for, you know, Toronto, almost in some parts where you walk through feels like you're in America again.
But, oh, totally.
Montreal has that, and Quebec City has that real difference.
Yeah, the architecture in Quebec and Montreal has been maintained from its oldest points, where in Toronto it gets refurbished or torn down. Lots of real estate plundering happening there, development, those sorts of things. Like people just ripping down 200-year-old buildings to put up a condo or something. So it's a bit of a drag. And I never lived in Toronto. I always visited, and sometimes I regretted it, and other times I really didn't. I like living just outside of it, so you could come and go as you wanted. Like, you know, get the good food, see the good show, but then you get to go home to, like, a smaller town and not deal with all the humanity and chaos. So, yeah.
There's that expression in Canada. Drive 6 hours for a six-pack of beer.
Yeah, that's right. That's true. It's a lot of driving, too. It's not fun to tour Canada because there's not a lot of stops. You got to drive for like 10 hours before you hit a city. It's a bit of a complicated place. But I do hope you're able to come to Alberta, or I'm able to travel to wherever you are, because I'd love to see the band. I've never seen Shame, speaking of missing out on things. But I love this record. Do you have a sense, I guess you probably don't at this point, but what's sort of next? I feel like earlier you said you had been writing in this last little while. Is that right?
Yeah. So we've just filmed A Tiny Desk. So that will come out whenever it comes out. And that was, we did it with did 3 songs off the record, a new record. Trumpet, saxophone, 2 violins and percussion.
Oh, so, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Which was amazing to spend time on. And now we're doing writing as well. And I just did a song with an artist called Lynx, who's amazing, called This Is The Hit, which came out today.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. And plug. And yeah, we're just going to continue writing. I mean, I think we kind of, we want to get back to it as soon as possible. You know, we took quite a while between our last record, and to some degree, I hope that that doesn't happen again. But at the same degree, you don't want to rush anything. And it was all circumstantial as well. So yeah, I think that's what we're going to do. And we'd love to have you at any of our shows anytime.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I hope I can make it for sure. I hope it happens. I hope it occurs that you can visit North America at least as soon as possible, obviously. If people want to learn more about Shame and Drunk Tank Pink, like, where would you want to kind of send them on the internet right now?
I don't know, to Instagram, I guess, or to Spotify for the album, or to their local independent record shop. They can purchase it there.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I don't, it's a good question. I don't know. I think
do you operate any of your band's sort of social media stuff?
Yeah, I do Instagram and Facebook, but I'm not very. I don't have Twitter. You know, I'm not sort of, as I said to you, I'm a bit of a Luddite. Yeah.
No, that's fine. No, it's good. You're not missing much. I just wonder.
We're not yet TikTok famous or anything.
No, it's fine. Very few of us are. And maybe for good reason. Well, no, that's fine. We'll find people. Again, the album is called Drunk Tank Pink. The band is Shame. Charlie, if we can go out on a song from the album, can you select one for me to play? And also, can you explain why you chose it?
Maybe Snow Day, which is the fifth song on the record, I think.
By my count, it is the sixth song potentially the second longest song on the record.
Clocking
in digitally anyway at 5 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yeah.
just being factually correct there. Why did you choose Snow Day?
To leave him laughing. No, I don't know. I don't know. I think that was one of the ones we did for Tiny Desk, and it was the first one we started out with. And you know, talking about isolation and stuff like that, but also with optimism. I think this is one of the themes we wrote it. Well, we wrote a few of the songs for this record in the Highlands in Scotland, which was again at Blackfriars Studios, which was again a very isolated but incredibly beautiful place to be. And yeah, I just think it's one we're all very proud of.
That's fair enough. Is there anything about, just given some of the lyrical things we discussed in terms of your intense dreams and the pink room you were in, does Snow Day speak to anything in particular?
This is probably the pivotal moment of that, of those themes, I would say. Yeah, I mean, it was like where we were staying, we were halfway up a mountain, and I used to just go and walk up that mountain. We used to walk up there every day, and it kind of begins with that, and sort of, you know, with heartbreak and everything falling to you. And yeah, that's it. But it's got a happy ending, I guess, I think.
Okay. All right.
And I was happy, instrumentally.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we'll play it for people now. This is Snow Day by Shame from their excellent record, Drunk Tank Pink. Charlie, this was really a pleasure for me. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope we speak again soon. Best of luck with everything in the future.
Mate, I loved it. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Of Mother Nature, I'm gonna close my eyes, and this is the only place I can do it. At the top of this hill, I sit down.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, as I said at the top there, I was feeling a little self-conscious about this episode. I feel badly that it didn't come out around when it was actually recorded. Again, apologies to Charlie and the Shame people and the publicists and everybody involved. But I told the publicist at the time, I don't know when this will come out. Like, I'll do it. And then it didn't come out. Because I, like, as you guys, the people who follow the show know, I like to peg things to topical things. And I couldn't find anything. And then it just, now there's stuff. I'm happy, though. I'm so happy that this has occurred, that I found a reason to put this out. And you still, you know, we're not talking about the new record. Maybe Charlie will be on again for the new record. I don't know. I haven't figured that out yet. But this is, you'd get to know Charlie a little bit. And they've got stuff coming up. So this is me talking myself into looking at the bright side of things. Thank you, Charlie, for appearing on this, now it's the 743rd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it and you're wondering if I actually put it out because we recorded it so long ago, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, which used to be the most evil social media platform, but currently I think is in fifth place. You can follow the show on Twitter, that's the evil one, at Vish Creative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram, third evil, at Vish Khanna. Please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 USD or more grants you access to exclusive content. Episodes come out earlier to those folks. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt at that tier, you can just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. I still have some of them. Thanks for supporting the show. That's the primary source of revenue. It's the least icky for me because it's you saying you want to support the show. And it's flexible. You can change whatever amount you start with. You can go up, you can go down. It's great. So thank you for that support. Patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to the wonderful Alberta record retailer Blackbird Music, which you can learn more about at blackbird.ca. Also want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. And a gentle reminder from me to support local independent businesses however and whenever you can. It really makes a huge difference. Thanks also to my friend who is himself an independent business, Jim Guthrie. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. Jim provides music to me for this show with a handshake and a smile. So Jim's the best. jimguthrie.org again to learn more about him. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Charlie from Shame, and for following this podcast or subscribing to it and telling your friends about it and spreading the word about it that way. Check out the music of Shame. It's wonderful. Charlie, as you can tell, is a wonderful and funny and thoughtful fellow. So it was nice to connect with him. Again, all apologies. This is my last time. Again, all apologies to the Shame people and also to the publicists involved in the delay, but I hope this was worth it. And that's it. I'm going to stop apologizing. I'm going to go live my life. I will talk to you very soon. Bye for now.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.